The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm talking to Sue Rabbati. She is the founder of the MedShadow Foundation. Their website is medshadow.org. And there you can find independent evaluations of many drugs, many therapies, even many natural therapies, because that's what they do. They kind of shadow developments in the medical field and invite expert journalists, investigative journalists, to write articles that clarify issues for the consumers. Am I stating that correctly, Sue?
Yes, you said very well. That was great.
Great. So you have something called the Choose Wisely campaign. Tell us about that. Actually, that's not yours. You're adopting.
Yes.
You can explain that, but it's not your campaign. It's actually a campaign that has been introduced by several medical groups, but it's an important campaign, and you comment on
yes.
it.
I do. We actually comment on it fairly frequently, at least three or four times a year. I write a blog almost every week on MedShadow.org, and quite often I'll pull up something from Choosing Wisely. You can find it if you go to choosingwisely.org, and it's a wonderful place to go to if you're about to go see a specialist. What this group, it's a medical foundation group, has gone to all the specialty medical associations and asked them to give between 5 and 10 tests that are unnecessary in many circumstances, and what circumstances they are. So, for example, for a checkup, if you have no other indicators for a heart condition, mm-hmm. getting an EKG is unnecessary,
right,
according to the specialist, for an annual checkup. Now, I've been getting an EKG every year, and I
yeah.
have to have
totally.
A little discussion with my doctor.
I stopped doing that so many years ago because it's just ridiculous. It's a good moneymaker because, you know, you send the bill to the insurance company or
yeah.
Medicare, and maybe you put down some kind of, you fudge a little bit. You put down a phony diagnosis like palpitations or something like that, and then you get reimbursement. But you explain why that's not a good idea. I mean, it sounds, you know, like, say you're 60 or 65, who knows? Maybe your heart went awry in the past year. Why is that not a good idea to get an EKG every year?
Well, there's the problem of it could be an overdiagnosis. An EKG might pick up on a very small irregularity that will never become a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
You could find a false positive. So the doctor then says, well, we're getting a strange rhythm on here, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to do just one more test to check it out. And it can become a landslide of unnecessary medical care, causing you stress. It causes you expense. And there can be damage. Mistakes can happen. You're opening yourself up to problems. If you, statistically speaking, very few people have a heart issue without symptoms, without other symptoms of
mm-hmm.
it. And your doctor will always go through those symptoms and ask you if you have them. And you can talk to your doctor about them. But without those symptoms, it's very unlikely the EKG is going to pick up anything except a false positive, according to choosingwisely.org.
Right. Well, that being said, I mean, a doctor may make a clinical decision that someone who's at very high risk, you know, perhaps they have diabetes and hypertension, mm-hmm. or the doctor hears a heart murmur, and maybe, just maybe, that is justified. So we needn't tell people, refuse an EKG if your doctor recommends it. Just be wary because, you know, doctors are sometimes Two pressures, I think, exist for doctors. One's an economic pressure to generate more income. I think, you know, that has to be said. But also doctors are sometimes in a CYA mode because they figure, well, you know, this patient probably doesn't need it, but just in case I'll do this or that or the other test, and then medical costs mount and false positives mount, causing additional testing and anxiety and expense.
Yes. A simple conversation with your doctor of why are we doing this test? Do I really need it? And what do we do next if we come up with an issue? There's some tests you take that, you know, there's nothing you're going to do about it anyway, even if it comes up positive. So why am I taking that test?
Mm-hmm. How about the routine chest X-ray? That's another one that needs to fall by the wayside.
They do say that there's, I haven't had a routine chest. I didn't know they were routine anymore. But, yeah, the routine chest X-rays were early on the list from choosing wisely to try it. Just ask if you really need it before you should do it. And also stress tests before dental surgery for seniors.
Yeah.
Many dentists will require it, and it's not considered necessary at all.
Mm-hmm. How about some of these gynecological procedures that they do on women, well into their 70s and 80s after a series of normal exams, or even women who've had hysterectomies? Isn't that on the list as well?
It is. There are certain tests, like pap smear, you should have probably, I'm not looking at the numbers, but you can stop when you're 70.
Mm-hmm.
But that's partly because it's really not an invasive test. And it's not a test that's that there are bad side effects from.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things like mammograms. You really don't need a mammogram after the age of 70. 70 becomes kind of this watershed year where you need to have a real discussion with your doctor on, you know, what do I need these tests? We can start stopping these tests.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my father was so happy. He came home from the dentist when he was 78, and he said, I'm never going to the dentist again. I'm so happy. And I said, why? And he said, he pulled my last tooth. I have no more teeth.
There you go.
I said, Dad, don't your gums need care? He said, let them rot.
Well, you know, it's clearly speaking as a physician, I think doctors sometimes cherry pick tests because they're reimbursed. And then they find a rationale to perform the tests on patients, thus, sometimes accruing to their bottom line. So, you know, I think consumers need to be wary, particularly where tests involve things like X-rays, where they're invasive. And we know that cumulative exposure to X-rays may somewhat increase our risk of cancer. So we got to be careful.
Well, the radiation from MRIs, unnecessary MRIs, you need to avoid those. MRIs for children who have concussions.
I think you're talking about CAT scans, because MRIs are not radiation. Yeah, CAT scans.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, these days when your kid falls off, when your kid falls off the jungle gym, because of liability, it's like, well, in the old days, they just put an ice pack on her head. But now it's like immediately, you know, you got to go to the ER and get a CAT scan just in case, because God forbid, you know, one in a million could be something. And, you know, then the kid's developing brain gets exposed to really high levels of radiation. We don't want that.
And, yes, too frequently.
Right. Okay, so how do you research a drug's side effects? I mean, this is really perplexing for a lot of my patients because, even just it's laughable watching these TV ads for drugs. Two-thirds of the commercial is a litany of horrendous side effects. If you really listen to that, you know, they usually show some pleasant bucolic scene, people having fun or in the country, but then they read these horrendous side effects. Should you be looking up side effects as a patient, and what do you do with that information? If you really paid attention to it, you wouldn't be taking anything.
Side effects can be very scary, and they can really affect your ability to take a drug that you really need. So you want to find out what the side effects are, and if there are side effects, how to manage them if you need to take that drug. So the first thing you want to do is ask your doctor all the questions you should when you're being prescribed a drug. We have a downloadable at medchannel.org, the five that are questions to ask your doctor.
Hmm, that's
and
good.
There are There are four questions, and you can download it and take it with you, because I know that I, like many people, walk into the doctor's office and suddenly feel just perfectly fine. No, I have no symptoms, and no, I have no questions. And that's not true. So I have to write everything down before I go to a doctor's office. So I've taken this list, and it has questions like, why am I being prescribed this drug? And then prompting questions, should I be taking a brand name or a generic? The next question would be, will this drug cure what I have, or are we just managing the symptoms? Am I always going to have this problem? PPIs, gastric distress drugs often, and sleeping aids.
Ulcer
often,
medications, yeah.
Yeah, those kind of medications are usually just managing the symptoms. So put you to sleep or mask the gastric distress, but they're not curing anything. And you want to know, what am I doing? What are the immediate side effects? And your doctor should be telling you what they are then. You can follow that up again with your pharmacist. Your pharmacist is a great source to you. And let me just put a plug in here for pharmacists. They're your best friend. There's an expression, and I'm probably going to mangle it, but you can correct it. And it is that doctors are disease specialists and pharmacists are drug specialists.
Okay.
And what is meant by that is that, you know, a doctor's got to know everything about your body and disease and everything, but the pharmacist knows how drugs interact with each other, how over-the-counter drugs will interact with prescription drugs. So that's a great first-line defense to go to on what side effects. Of course, I would say go to MedChannel.org and look up what the side effects are.
And indeed, you know,
and
this
the
whole,
last question.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The last question on our list of questions to ask your doctor are, have there been studies about the long-term effects? And will my body build a tolerance for this drug? If I'm going to be taking it for a few weeks or months or years, like statins or beta blockers, can there be a toxic buildup in my body for this drug? Will my body develop a tolerance, so I have to take higher levels, like you do with sleeping aids? All good questions to know before you start taking that drug.
So what if the doctor, you know, turns hostile on you and says, hey, listen, you know, who's got the medical degree here? I'm the doctor. I think it's in your interest to take this medication. I don't really have time to answer your litany of questions here because I got a whole waiting room full of patients. So, you know, basically, I'm not going to go there. Is that, what do you do as a consumer, as a patient, when you confront that?
That's a very difficult problem, because what I want to say is find a new doctor, but not everybody has that option. You might be part of an HMO group that makes you, you know, that forces you to go to this particular practice. So you need to manage your relationship with your doctor. Hopefully, of those four questions that I just mentioned, if a doctor is bringing up a drug, he or she has already given you two of the answers, so you can just skip to the two that you need. You could parse out your questions if you continue to need to go to this doctor, and you can use other sources. You go online to medshadow.org, you talk to your pharmacist, you talk to the nurse. You can ask your doctor, how can we work best together for me to get my questions answered without wasting your time, doctor?
Right. And I think that that's the essence of it, is that, you know, I think these days doctors are beleaguered. Sometimes they feel threatened by patient empowerment. And I think the answer is to say, look, it's in both our interest to partner on this because we want a good outcome. And the more well-informed and motivated I am, and the more aware I am of potential downsides, the better I can help with your management of this, doctor. And you know, I think most doctors would respond to that.
I think most doctors will. I mean, every doctor is going to have a bad day. Heaven knows I have a bad day, and they get to have a bad day once in a while, too. But your relationship with your doctor should go on for several years, and hopefully you develop a good dialogue with that doctor.
Indeed. Unless you outlive your doctor, which is seems to be pretty prevalent these days, given the mortality statistics and stress the doctors are subject to. All right. So when you also review some things that are not strictly pharmaceutical. For example, you did a series on food as medicine. What's that all about?
We did. Food as medicine and exercise as medicine. We've done a few variations on the theme, and we think that in order, if we're going to tell you to question drugs and to worry about the side effects and to try to manage the side effects, we need to give you alternatives. Not every condition needs to have a drug. For example, if you're on statins, it might be if you just lose 5 or 10 pounds, you'll end up not needing the statins anymore. Sometimes it's as simple as that. So we try to suggest, particularly, let's see, for exercise, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, exercise can make a huge difference in your need for medicine there, both aerobic and strength testing. We have an article specifically on exercise as medicine, and there you'll see what types of exercise, what level of intensity that you have to go through to get a good effect. But it's less than you would think. 3 times a week at moderate intensity can make a huge amount of difference in how much medicine you need to manage diabetes. High blood pressure, heart disease, exercise is known to lower blood pressure. It's a cornerstone of blood pressure management. So just, again, that it's 2-3 times a week. It'll make a huge difference. And insomnia is another classic. So food can have an effect on osteoarthritis and breast cancer and celiac disease. We cover a lot of that right on the website.
And so that's important information people can access. You weigh in on the medical marijuana controversy as well. Tell us about that.
We do. I actually went to a conference in Boulder, Colorado the week that they were, was it 3 years ago, the week that they approved it for social use, medical marijuana.
So it, Rocky it Mountain was High. Yeah.
It was. And I had the pleasure of talking to the state attorney general who was in charge of managing how they were going to keep people safe when it was safe to get high. You know, the questions of, can you smoke pot and drive a car? Can you have a pot jelly bear and teach a kindergarten class? Those are all pretty big issues. One of the questions I asked was, how come you can't just treat marijuana like it's wine? I did a blog, actually, with that title, I think. Mm-hmm. Why is it pot like wine? Because I know exactly what my limits are, you know,
right,
how much I can drink and
right,
and be able to drive or function or not.
Yep.
And as it turns out, I didn't realize that marijuana is very unstable.
Yep.
And so it will, if you say you have a headache and you use marijuana to manage your headache, it's a health use that is becoming more common. If you have a headache that you would gauge, say, a 6 on a scale of 1 to 10 today, and you have one marijuana brownie, that might be fine to manage that number 6 headache. But tomorrow you have the same level number 6 headache and the same brownies, you might need 2 or 4 or even 8, because there's, I believe, and do you know the number of stuff you had? Is it a 1 to 8 ratio?
Mm.
So it can vary within your body.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it a matter of the strength of the marijuana or the way it's metabolized differently by different people? I guess a lot of different factors.
It is not the strength at all. Yeah, you can have exactly the same strength and exactly the same personal symptoms, but your body will metabolize marijuana so differently every single time you take it.
Okay.
That there's no predicting.
Right. And so that differs. I mean, with your analogy to wine, it's kind of like people kind of know, like, you know, when I have a glass of wine, this is how I feel. Pretty much, you know, it's kind of a routine. But
yeah,
you just don't know. And then, I mean, I throw this in, is that from what I hear, you know, since, you know, I have to say I did inhale, you know, following the inimitable statement of one of our former presidents. Now, you know, I just don't know what's out there. They claim that what's out there can be by many magnitudes stronger than previous forms of marijuana. And then there's different types of marijuana. It's pretty much, you know, when you look at a bottle, it'll say it's, you know, 12% alcohol or 14% alcohol, or with spirits, it might be, you know, 40% alcohol. But with pot, you know, it's kind of hard to quantitate that and determine, you know, how you're going to feel after imbibing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of change in the field of marijuana over the next few years. There are people working, and a lot of people working with developing a marijuana that doesn't have the THC in it, which
the CBD, the cannabidiol.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so we're very interested in that here on Intelligent Medicine, because I think there really is therapeutic potential for that. And we're no longer talking about medical marijuana for if you're a terminal cancer patient, you're suffering from chemotherapy nausea, or you just want to put yourself out of your misery with pain. We're talking about the potential anti-inflammatory effects, the effects on conditions like MS, ulcerative colitis, and so on. And without the hallucinogenic effects, without the stoner effects of marijuana.
Yes, it could be a really great and wonderful field, but it's still a few years away. We haven't been able to do, the medical research field has really been very limited in what research could be done on marijuana, because it was so limited by the government. You couldn't legally get it except under very strict standards, and then, you know, was it the kind of pot that they're using today? So there's a lot of problems with it today, but I think we'll see a big difference in 5 to 10 years.
Okay, well, these are some of the issues that you can scope out by checking out medshadow.org. It's the Med Shadow Foundation. Our guest, Sue Robati. And Sue, is there anything else that you want to touch upon in terms of issues that you cover?
Well, there's so much going on in this area, and side effects have come really to the top, the forefront of people's attention, and I'm really glad about that. Cold and flu, it's cold and flu season out there.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah, there are some issues out there. People need to be aware that when you're using a cold and flu remedy that has multiple ingredients in it, there's probably acetaminophen in it. So if you pop a couple of Tylenol and then take some cold and flu medicine that has multiple ingredients in it, you probably double the amount of acetaminophen that you can safely take. And you can quickly and without knowing it bump up on the upper levels of what's safe levels of acetaminophen to take, which can damage your liver and damage it pretty quickly within a few days if you maintain that. So read the labels, look at the article. We have a whole article just came out this week on cold and flu. But just remember that colds and flus, and I know you've told this to your people many times, but everyone should know this. Cold and flus do not respond to antibiotics. Please don't go to your doctor and ask for an antibiotic for your cold or your flu. Don't ask for a Z-Pack. It's not going to help.
Yeah, I mean, so people say, well, you know, I'm going to get it on a plane. I want to make sure they get an antibiotic prescription. They take it just in case. And that just is terrible because, first of all, it's not going to be effective. And secondly, it will decrease the chances that you'll respond to the antibiotic when you need it. Plus, it may mess up your intestinal flora. We know how important the microbiome is for overall health.
On so many levels.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about Tamiflu?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Right. My take on Tamiflu is that maybe it's warranted for people who are very, very seriously ill with the flu. But what we're seeing is lack of response to Tamiflu. We're seeing side effects with Tamiflu, even psychiatric side effects. Plus, the timing of it makes it kind of impractical because by the time you get through to your doctor and your doctor prescribes it, you're likely to be past the point where it's going to be effective. So, you know, short of stockpiling it, which is not a great idea either, I'm not sure the Tamiflu is warranted. You know, I have another one for you, which is comes to me from my New England Journal of Medicine Journal Watch, which is about, and you probably heard about this, it's called something called phenylephrine. You know, there's Sudafed, but, you know, when you go to the drugstore to buy Sudafed, they practically, you know, shake you down. They want a complete Homeland Security check on you because they think that you're going to turn it into make it into methamphetamine, because that's the way methamphetamine makers, the people who run these meth labs, they go around to pharmacies and buy Sudafed and then they cook it down. And that's a component. So the alternative is something called phenylephrine, and it's an ingredient in many over-the-counter oral decongestants. It's very readily available. But according to a new study, phenylephrine is no more effective than placebo for nasal congestion. So there you go. That's another thing that's widely available. But, you know, when the studies come in, turns out doesn't really make it.
Perfect. That's another one for my placebo line of drugs.
There you go. Hey, listen.
Yes.
It even has like a fancy name, so you can't just call it placebo. And, you know, if you package it right and you put it in the decongestant aisle, a lot of people are going to obtain relief from it, especially if they plunk down, $6 or $8 or $10 for a bottle of it.
And first off, I will be doing no harm.
Exactly. Well, we're not sure that phenylephrine does no harm. Well, all we know is that it's not efficacious.
No, my placebo will do no harm, yes.
Yeah, because they do report that one participant in the 40-milligram phenylephrine group reported serious adverse effects of chest and lower jaw pain, which resolved after the drug was stopped. That sounds like angina or heart pain. Yeah. Okay, so there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's 40 milligrams, that's a lot of stuff.
Better you should take a placebo. So anyway, so lots of good information along these lines. You keep them honest at the Med Shadow Foundation. It's a very worthwhile site for our listeners to be aware of. Medshadow.org. Anything else to add, Sue?
Thank you for having me on today. You were great. Thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure. Sue Robati of the Med Shadow Foundation. Check it out. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.